Race Forward, an in-depth look at race relations from voices in our community. A special presentation of Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600.
Joining me now is Carolyn Vermont. She is a community advocate in Bridgeport, but also a former NAACP president. Carolyn, thanks so much for being here this morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Absolutely. And actually, over the weekend, I could not find Carolyn's number. I couldn't figure out. It was something I was calling you about. I don't remember what it was, but I was calling, and you were at a rally this past weekend, no?
Yes, I was. I was.
So, tell us a little bit about what you're kind of seeing in our community.
So there have been a number of rallies, protests. So this past weekend, I did attend one down at McLevy Green. And, that one was some of the younger voices. And then on Sunday, also attended another one organized by students from Fearful University and Sacred Heart University. And so that one was a peaceful protest in March also. And so, what I'm seeing is that, people are really saddened, traumatized by what's happening here in America with people of color being killed by law enforcement. And so the people that are at the protest, they're really being the voice for the voiceless. But they're also taking it a step further. They're saying, we need action, we need change. And so they're talking with legislatures about changing some of the laws.
And, I think that you hit the nail on the head that I think we're seeing with these protests that they want to take things a step further. Now, as a former president of the NAACP, do you find that it's kind of frustrating? It's irritating to see that there's still such deep-rooted issues amongst communities, not just here, but all over the world, really, when it comes to something as simple as comparing people because of the color of their skin. Do you find that there are still these frustrations, and that in some ways we've made progress, but in other ways it seems like we've taken six steps back in a lot of ways?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we're talking about going back over 400 years, unequal treatment of blacks in America and the world. And so here we are 401 years later, and things haven't really changed much. I mean, we've made some progress, but, when you look at those that we have seen on video, you look at Eric Garner, and the way that, he was murdered, at that point, you start thinking in your head, okay, so we're looking at this, we see this, and somehow the cops that were involved, they got off. And so, and then we witnessed George Floyd, similar actions against him causing his death. And those are just the ones that we've seen on video. There have been so many others that we have not seen with our own eyes. But of course, today now with, everyone being able to videotape from their cameras, it's right there in front of us. And so it's sad. It's traumatizing because, once you see it happen to one person in your mind, you're thinking, okay, this cannot happen again, but it continues to happen.
So, that's the thing, though, is it continues to happen. So how do you stay motivated as a community advocate? How do you continue to show up to rallies? How do you continue to do the work that you're doing in the community?
You just can't stop. I mean, I'm an African Caribbean black woman, so I'm living this every day. So I don't have a choice. I can't go home and say, okay, I really don't have to deal with this. I have to deal with this. It's my reality. So, feeling traumatized, feeling angry, feeling tired, you still just have to keep going. Hopefully making things not just better for the next generation, but for us, making a change right now for all of us.
We keep hearing that. I keep hearing that from almost everyone that comes on the show and that I've talked to off the air. tired, just being so tired. You know, and I think that you bring up so many points, Carolyn, that don't really get addressed. Do you find that there are ways that we could better address this? You know, is there a way that we could look, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years down the road, and it can be easier to talk about these things instead of you guys holding this in? And I say you guys so general, so I apologize. I don't mean that. But like, is there a way that it doesn't need to be suppressed anymore? I find it's so for me, my heart hurts that there are friends of mine that never told me that when we walked down the street together, they got weird looks and I just never noticed them. It makes me feel like I was a horrible friend. It makes me feel like I didn't notice a problem for 30 years of my life. It makes me feel like that I could have been doing more. And I just wish that there was a way to do more. I don't mean to like spew on, but you know, what would be your advice to make this better, be able to talk about this more, make it more normal so that you guys don't have to keep swallowing the things that are going on? It's horrible.
I think we have to have more conversations, bring more awareness to racism. You know, it's all mm-hmm. about racism. Blacks are definitely treated, blacks and browns, differently than white people. And so it's bringing awareness and doing all that you can to bring about change. You know, one of the rallies that I attended in Westport, the organizer, Darcy Hicks, she said, okay, it's fine. It's fine to recognize racism and say I'm not a racist. But what are you going to do about it? What mm-hmm. are you going to do to help the underprivileged, the disadvantaged? And so, you know, how are you going to create equity? You know, one of the organizations that I'm involved with is the National Coalition of 100 Black Women. So, you know, we're fighting for pay equity for Black women, for equal access to health care, for economic equity. But we shouldn't have to fight for that.
No.
You know, it should be natural.
I agree.
So if you are in a position to create change, you know, you're the head of a company. So make sure that the opportunities are there for people of color, and not that, you know, when two people apply, if I apply and I'm black and a white person apply and we have equal education, equal experience, there shouldn't be that level of favoritism towards that white person just because they look like you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, the opportunity yeah. should be there for all. Housing, you know, it's mainly people of color that's living in these substandard housing. So let's create affordable housing for all. Healthcare, same thing. You know, so it's those opportunities, creating opportunities for all. And so people do have the power. I don't know if they don't realize they don't have it, that they do have it, or they refuse to use that power.
Mm.
But people, you know, they have a lot more power than they're utilizing right now
yeah.
for us to reach equality and equity.
Carolyn, do you find that a big problem with why racism still exists is because it's a generational thing? So the reason I ask this question is because, you know, when we were going through civil rights, slavery, all of that, all of a sudden there was a big shift. And when there was a time of African Americans going to separate bathrooms and so on and so forth, all of a sudden there was a shift and everybody was together. And do you think that sometimes racism is built because there are such deep roots generations ago where you just didn't talk about it? You didn't really talk about the fact that there was a shift, or the fact that there was a time where, for some godforsaken reason, blacks worked for whites. Do you think that that has anything to do with why racism is still alive and well?
I think that's part of it. And I think sometimes people are just not thinking beyond their comfort zone. For instance, I had a conversation last night with someone who said they, you know, felt really bad at their company because, you know, they had some job openings, but they said, you know, Black people just didn't apply. So when they looked at their pool of applicants, it was predominantly white people. But then, you know, I had to push back a little bit. I said, well, where did you do your advertising? You know, was it just Indeed.com, or did you get, you know, the advertisement out to the Black churches? Did you send it to the National Coalition of 100 Black Women, to the NAACP, to the National Black MBA? So I think, you know, there are some people are saying, you know, I've tried, but you really didn't try hard enough. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to go where we are to reach us. And so I think people have to think differently. And, you know, and for some people, it's deep rooted. You know, this is the way they were raised in their homes. You know, it was probably a white neighborhood, white school. All their activities were with other, you know, white students, those that look like them. Mm-hmm. So now to be out there in the wider world now to try to embrace others that look different from them, different cultures, that's where the challenge comes in.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I think for a lot of, I would say some white people too, it's this superiority mentality that, you know, I am better than that darker skinned person. And so, you know, that's something people will have to get over if we're ever going to reach a level of equality and ready to provide, you know, opportunities mm-hmm. for others.
That mentality to me is crazy. And I don't care if that's opinionated. I know I work in news and we're supposed to be unbiased, but that to me is insane. I will never understand that mentality of anyone being better than anybody. Because, look, I know that I'm certainly not what you'd call the typical. I definitely follow more of a Christian standpoint on pretty much everything in my life. But the way I look at it is I sin, you sin. We all are imperfect people. We were all created, though, in the image of God. And who am I to say that I'm better than somebody else or you're better than somebody else or I could judge you for this? And I think that, Carolyn, the thing that bothers me the most about the George Floyd case is I'm finding weeks later that people are getting distracted by details like if George Floyd had a criminal record, if, you know, he and Derek Chauvin knew each other beforehand and they had problems. Here's the problem is that somebody thought they had the right to kill another person. That's the problem. And it doesn't matter what color each party was. Somebody took someone's life and thought they had the right to do that. No matter if you have a badge or you don't, or you're white or you're Black or you're rich or you're poor or whatever the case may be. And I don't know if you feel this way, but I think more times than none, we bring something to the forefront. But then we get super distracted by details that actually have nothing to do with just being caring for one another.
Absolutely. And it happens a lot with, you know, with Blacks who are victims who have been murdered by police officers. They start bringing out the history, the negative history, you know, well, they've been arrested or they got in trouble when they were 6 years old. But you usually don't see that for whites that have killed someone. For instance, the student from UConn, you know, you see the stories of, you know, there were some mental health issues. But when a Black person kills someone else, you rarely ever see anything written about any childhood trauma they've experienced,
mm-hmm.
just the trauma of racism that
right.
they have to live with every day that may have contributed, you know, to their mindset.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, just in general in the media, Blacks and whites are handled differently mm-hmm. when it comes to crimes, whether you are the victim or you're the perpetrator. You know, again, the Black victim, it's usually any negative information they could find on that person comes out. So it's almost just trying to justify the murder of the person. Say, you know, well, he really wasn't a good person anyways. So maybe he was deserving of this, which is, you know, just adds to the trauma that we have to live with every day.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. What would be your, and this is such a question that I just keep asking everybody, because I think the more that we can brainstorm, you know, maybe we could take a step forward. What would be your answer? You know, I know that Governor Lamont did not wait for a special session, which I was proud of him for doing that. I thought, I don't even know why we're going to debate this. We've got issues. Let's just sign a document that says you can't do this, which I think is ridiculous. We have to even have a rule that says don't put someone in a chokehold or do anything that would stop them from having oxygen. I think it's insane that we need a rule to say that, but I'm glad he at least signed off on it without really anybody else putting feedback into that. What would you say can be done on our level? You know, the yous and the me's of the world, the ones who don't necessarily have a lawmaker status or are police officers or anything like that. We are just common people just going about our days. What can we do to fix this?
I think for the common people, and again, I would say work on fixing it, because racism didn't come about overnight, so I don't think we're going to be able to eliminate it overnight. However, if people can be more tolerant of other cultures, be ready to embrace other cultures, see the value in other cultures. You know, many times on TV, even for our young ones, you know, when they see commercials on TV or news report, it's you see black people and brown people in such a negative light. And so, you know, I think if we can just change those images for them to see people that look like them in more of a positive light. But, you know, as far as, you know, white people, I think they have to really make up their minds that, okay, we can be just one people. But, you know, I have to take that step to embrace other people that don't look like me, to gain a greater understanding and to realize that people who don't look like me are of value also, and they've contributed so much to this country and continue to contribute so much to this country. So whenever I hear, you know, like, oh, congratulations, we have our first, you know, whatever. I was so happy for President Barack Obama, our first black president. But look,
how long did that take?
Right. There's a shame, like, and anger. Why did it take so long to get here?
Why should we be proud of that? Right.
Yes.
Right.
So even in Bridgeport, you know, when we had our first black police chief, like, why did it take
that long?
So long? So part of it is that willingness to create opportunities. And that's something everyone can do. Whatever level you are at, you can help to create opportunities for others that don't look like you.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Carolyn Vermont, thank you so much for giving such amazing insight and looking into this and answering my questions and just having a conversation with me about this. I really do appreciate it. So thank you.
Yes. And, you know, and I must say, you know, I have a lot of white friends that have been calling me, you know, just saying, what can I do? How are you doing? How are you feeling? What can I do? And I truly appreciate that. You know, but these are friends that are already conscious of what's happening and are aware of racism and willing to do all that they can to eradicate racism.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I appreciate that. And I do love the messages that you've given us this morning. It really just rings true for sure, especially here, but across the entire world. You know, I hope that we can step forward, you know, take some steps forward. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Have a wonderful day.
Thanks. You too. Speaking right now with Brad Rumble, who is a friend of mine. We go to the same church, and actually we connected over his story of becoming a Christian rapper. And I think his story is one that's for the record books. Brad, thanks for being here this morning. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Melissa. It's good to be here.
Yeah, thanks for being here.
Hope you're having a great morning.
Thank you. It's been a very enlightening morning. It's been tough to hear some people's stories and just hear about what people go through. And but it's been, to me, very eye-opening. It's been an amazing opportunity and a blessing to have people who are willing to share with me and my audience. So I appreciate it. And it's certainly been... It's been a morning. That's for sure.
That's so awesome.
Thanks. Brad, tell us your story, you know, and tell the story that you told us at church, because I think your testimony over a year ago, it brought my husband and I to tears because it was just an incredible story and one that you're not going to find maybe in the newspapers or anything like that. But I want to bring it to light here on the show. So could you share that with us?
Yeah, I'm just trying to pinpoint which part of it. just in my upbringing, I grew up in a Christian household. My father was a pastor. Grew up in Stamford, Connecticut, and pretty much I grew up in church, but I didn't really want anything to do with church, and so. Just with that, I kind of pursued, instruments and things of that nature in middle school and brought it with me to my first year of high school. And I actually played the flute and I played the saxophone. And so it's always I don't want to say it's a funny story, but the way that I got into making hip hop music in the first place was I wrote poems in, fifth grade, sixth grade, didn't really tell anybody about it. And I kind of wrote music up until my freshman year in high school. And I remember I had some friends of mine that, stole my notebook and they were like, dude, like you should be a rapper. I was like, no, like I'm good. Kind of my focus in that time was playing an instrument. And so when I got to ninth grade, I had a teacher who I told her, I said, ma'am, I don't have, a saxophone. And she was like, oh, don't worry about it. We'll get you one. And so I came to class every single day asking for the saxophone. I was just told, don't worry about it. And, the first quarter passed and I got an F. And I was like, okay, I went to the teacher and was like, hey, so I had a failing grade. I've been showing up every day. I participated as much as I could with that instrument. What can I do? And I was pretty much told, it's not my problem. So I went to my guidance counselor, kind of confused. And basically he just said, hey, look, you should just kind of switch into another class. And there wasn't really any explanation for it. And it was actually that year that I began making music. Really because music was my passion when it came to, instruments, but I didn't have an outlet for it. And actually come to find out that following year that teacher was fired for being prejudiced to a lot of other African-American students.
Wow.
And so that kind of actually catapulted just making music in general and then finding my own personal salvation with the Lord at 17. Really just revolutionized what I believe was the trajectory of my purpose, which has just led me to where I am today.
Now, Brad, when you got into rapping, one of the things that I'm sure was a little bit challenging is the fact that, rap artists sometimes, no pun intended, but they get a bad rap. There's some discrimination against rappers as well. So to go into that industry when there's already unfortunate racism in our communities, why push forward with that career choice if you felt like it may just draw more attention, poor attention, to yourself?
Wow, that's a good question. I think I have a good friend of mine. I'm trying to shout out my friend Eric Vanderkult. I remember one time he told me he told me to, because I have long hair, I have dreads, and he told me he doesn't think I should cut my hair. And I mean, me and myself, I'm not cutting my hair for a while anyways, but the power that came behind it was the stigma behind a black rapper who has dreadlocks. And it can easily become synonymous with, if you're talking violence, you're talking, you know, drugs, you're talking all of those kind of things. And I think that the way that I have utilized music to bring a flip on, you know, hope and purpose and vision and all of these things, I think that it's important to have these kind of sounds so that people can have a variety to listen to, opposed to having one mainstream, so to speak, way of thinking through the format of music. And I think why it's powerful for, I mean, just me being the way that I am and how I look, is it's also important to show that there isn't just one way of looking when it comes to like an artist's appearance, but also just me as an individual's appearance, and just redeeming some of those elements, because I think it's easy to judge by appearance and to not, you know, the Bible says that man look at the outside, but God looks at the heart. And I don't I don't think we spend a lot of time even desiring to get to know the hearts of people, to know why things may look like they look on the outside.
Yeah. And I, you know, and I don't know if you can attest to this, Brad, but the one thing that I keep telling my listeners about, or even when I have conversations, especially recently, is that I don't think it's possible to really do anything if you don't have God in your heart. I don't think you can possibly look at somebody, even if they make less money than you, even if they look different than you, even if they're not from this country, and really say, hey, we're equal. We're different, but we're equal. Unless you can really, truly believe at the center of your core that everyone was created in the image of God, not one of us was created without his love, and in that we're not better than each other, and that we're all imperfect, and that we all come up short, and that the only one who's perfect is God. And if God made all of us, then who are we to say that somebody is worse than another or better than somebody else? Would you agree that if you're lacking that, you know, that racism may never go away if we can't at least come to the same conclusion that we were all created equally?
Yeah. Man, I think you're spot on. It's hard to be able to see someone that has been created to think of the concept of not only God, but to, if you don't have the belief that you come from the same creator, then it's hard to even see that person better than yourself, if not even equal than yourself. And that's really, I think, where the problem lies, is that if people don't have an understanding of a God who not only loves us all equally, but died for all of us, then we will be very select on how we see the world. And we can very well just only see the world through our skin color, our eyes, our culture. And we miss out on so many other things.
Yeah.
There's an artist that I listen to. His name is KB. And he has this song called Long Live the Champions. And it's a song he said, how do you love a country's food more than its people? And it's so interesting, you know, if we're going to particularly speak about, you know, America, is that we have so many different cultures, so many different experiences that we can have, so many different restaurants, and it's just embedded into our nation. And it's hard to see all of these cultures and the cultures we appreciate and not want to understand where it comes from and the people behind it. And then just say, no, we'll take your things, but we don't want to take you. And so without having God in that, it'll be really hard to see.
Absolutely. Well, Brad, thank you for taking the time to share your testimony and also to give some you know, insight as to how we move forward with all of this. I really appreciate it. And certainly I know my audience appreciates hearing from you as well. So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. No problem. Tara Cornwell is a former Bridgeport school teacher now in Hartford. And Tara, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm doing okay, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
Yes, I know I only have a few minutes with you, but, you know, Tara, there was something that stood out to me when you and I talked last week. I want you to be able to, if you don't mind, share what you experienced when you were working in Bridgeport and you were being asked to maybe go to other school districts. You were being offered jobs in other school districts. Can you share what you went through? Because, honestly, it's haunted me ever since we've talked, if I'm being honest with you.
Okay. Well, as a young Black educator, I went to a lot of pilot programs. I went through a lot of interviews as I advanced up, and I was in that administrative status. I went to apply at places like Greenwich, Weston, Bristol, and one of the things that candidly always stayed with me was the reaction of how to approach me and tell me that I was going to be the only Black individual in that position. And one of the questions that I could say overall that was presented to me was that what would I do if, like, a white child or parent called me nigger? And I was saying, that's going to happen? They're going to actually call me that? So, or what would I do?
That was asked to you during an interview?
Yes, yes. And what would I do with parents coming to me if I approached a parent regarding a negative racist comment that their child did? And how would I reply now? Because these kids have higher economic standing, so their parents are going to treat you differently, and they're going to have these high expectations of what is due to their child. And I said, whoa. And I literally, like, you know, I walked away, made them always believe that I was going to take their job. And while I was driving home, I was going, you know, they got to be losing their mind. It's not worth six figures to take all that abuse. So I guess what stayed with me always is that, number one, I was very pleased that they educated me as to what I would be walking into. And then number two, that there's no monetary figure that they can offer me to belittle myself and take that position and be that person that is subdued with so much abuse within that higher economic community of teachers and administrators that I would now be surrounded with as only one Black person in that district at that time.
But you know what, Tara, to me, what stands out in that interview particularly is that you've got an environment where, yes, they did inform you, and okay, that's a positive, and kudos to you for calling it that, but from my standpoint, I still sit back in my seat when you tell me that, because to me, it just seems like complacency. Like,
yeah,
you're expecting your children that attend your school to probably call out a person of color and in a demeaning and degrading way with that word. And you're expecting that to happen. So are you failing as an educator when you know that this is what's going to happen when you bring an African-American teacher into your school system? That's a problem.
Yeah, but what was the reality of it as growing up, that this was a way of life? It was pushed underneath the rug. It wasn't brought forward. And I think as we got older and as the years came by, it for many years, it just was pushed underneath the rug. It was passive. It was acceptable. It was done, and you turned the other cheek and you ignored it. And you know, while it grew, it manifested itself. But it took so many years to, you know, explode at this level, because it was happening all over, but it became a norm. And people became used to it, and this was what it was, because this is what I was exposed to, and this is what I fought against all my life.
I mean,
you know, I've been to EEOC, I've been to CHRO, I've been to the Judicial Review Board, I've been to filed numerous complaints, so I'm just one of a few individuals that have always fought with my pen and paper, and that's what made me survive. If anybody knows me, I was always writing and against everything because they didn't know, you know, that I was going through this war, but you didn't talk about it. Here I was. I went to Southern Connecticut, and it took me 40 years to discuss and tell people about a trash can that was threw out of the dormitory of Southern Connecticut University, and it almost hit me for all my, I know in my life and bringing up and knowing God, that God pushed that garbage away from me and made sure that it didn't hit me. And who came running out? It was a group of RAs that said, you got to fill out a complaint. You got to fill out a complaint. Mm-hmm. And I ran because I'm like, white guys just threw garbage at me, and now you're running towards me. I'm out of here.
Yeah,
you know?
It's a scary. It's so scary.
So, again, I didn't talk about it because we didn't talk about it. We just let it manifest inside of us. Now we have so many avenues that offer free publishing. So, you know, to get this information out there, get it in a book. It doesn't cost any money. You know, put it out there. If you combined all this information, they got to listen. You know what I mean? There's no track record of all these events happening over years because people have been so quiet, and yet they've walked in silence that this has been happening over and over again till it finally manifested to being people being killed out in the broad daylight, you know. But this is years of oppression still there, but we let it become part of the norm. You know, we let it become a part of society. We let it be accepted. We let it be part of our life because we didn't speak out loud about it. And when you did stand, trust me, you stood alone because everybody was always threatened and afraid of their job or their way of life or their security or even their livelihood, you know. So I could understand their fear, but you have to always think about your legacy and your children and who's coming behind you. And that's why I always stood with 2 feet on the ground. And I said, my father kept telling me, I got to promote change. And when I thought about him in 1922 when he was born and he came over, and I remember always looking at him like, wow, the old, the young, the little baby, you go, yes, ma'am, no, sir, yes, boss. I mean, here it was. I was witnessing a 75-year-old man, you know, saying yes, ma'am, to a young white lady, 17 years old, you know, and, you know, people that he did work for, yes, boss. Everybody was boss. And I'm like, wow, I guess, you know.
Why do you have to refer to them that way?
Coming from that way of life, he never changed. And I was talking to my ex, and he said his father was like that too. So, you know, because we were brought up in families like that, and the discussion was the only way out is an education. That's the only tool we were given. It wasn't no tool like, you know, go fight discrimination, go fight racism. You know, the tool was get an education, you know. And, you know, I guess we weren't supposed to talk out loud that, you know, this really existed and this was happening, and the plight that we were going to be up against, we kind of just were thrown out there.